queue. Simon.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and welcome to Crave, the podcast dedicated to music, to film, and actually to all manner of entertainment that's caught the eye of me and Steve McCabe lately.
Now, this week, we've got a couple of films which really are likely to be Oscar contenders, I think, to be fair. We've got Bradley Cooper getting in front of and behind the camera. Versatile chap, that fella, isn't he? And he's sharing singing and acting duties with Lady Gaga in a new version of A Star Is Born.
Absolutely. Also, director Damien Chazelle teams up again with Ryan Gosling, this time for the story of Neil Armstrong in a movie called First Man.
Now, we've got one of the best ensemble casts to have hit the screen in years for the British crime caper, King of Thieves. The big question is, did they do it justice?
Yeah, I can't wait for you to tell me that, Steve. Another crime, an awful one, because it actually happened. We're talking about whether British director Paul Greengrass can do something, I guess, worthwhile with his film 22 July about that awful slaughter of students in Norway.
And on a slightly more cheerful note, we haven't forgotten about music this year, because we have neglected music a bit recently, haven't we, to be fair?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a movie season, I think.
It has. Well, it's winter, it goes that way, but spring is here. And so, Simon, you've caught a bunch of young, Australian even, exponents of soul and blues, the Teskey Brothers. And I gather you're fairly positive about them, aren't you?
Oh, I think I am, and I'll tell you a bit about them a bit later on. But that's to come.
Absolutely.
Steve, let's start with film, and we should mention, Steve, that, you know, usually, we're doing something a little bit different this week, aren't we? I mean, as you might expect, Steve and I would get together, have a bit of a chat before our podcast, compare a few notes.
Because we're professional like that, aren't we?
Oh, you know, we are.
I mean, this kind of brilliance and this kind of natural genius doesn't simply happen spontaneously. It takes planning and preparation. So
we might be about to throw that all out the window. Because this week, we have not said anything to each other about what we think about this new version of A Star Is Born, the one that is directed by Bradley Cooper. I have no idea what Steve thinks of it, and vice versa. So, Mr. McCabe, over to you. First, let's start with whether we liked it or not, and maybe that's not an easy question to answer, but did you like it?
Yes.
Okay, well, I will also say, just to put it on the record, yes. Okay, well, that's a good start. Two yeses.
But I do hear, similar to what I was trying to interject in there, a slightly qualified yes. And I think the interesting conversation is going to come out the qualifications in there.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think that... Okay, let me just do another little statement to just get the ball rolling a bit more. I utterly enjoyed the performances.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Bradley Cooper... he's a good actor, we know that. He did very, very well playing music, and it was him singing, it was his voice, we are told. And I enjoyed Lady Gaga's performance and some other performances as well, like Sam Elliott as the brother, Dave Chappelle. I really enjoyed his little cameo. So there's some great performances, and it is basically a romance, isn't it, Steve? So
yes.
I think they do the romance really, really well, and it certainly moved me. Where I would just, I had paused to think, and I do confess, I think I'd seen a headline about this along the way somewhere, and that's about the actual story, the treatment of the story, and in 2018, whether this was the right way to tell this story. I won't say any more on that now, but you know, I want to throw it back to you just to get some more thoughts from you.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the story, let's just get this out of the way very quickly, is a fairly well-known one, because this is, depending on who's counting, the fourth or possibly the sixth telling of this tale.
Okay, right.
It's been kicked around. I mean, I was speaking to my mother, who is obviously of, you know, earlier vintage than you or I, and I mentioned that I was going to see this new film, A Star Is Born, and she said, oh, well, I remember the old version. I said, which one? And she said, Judy Garland.
Oh, my gosh.
Exactly.
Wow.
So, I mean, I was expecting her to invoke... what's her name?
Barbara Streisand.
Barbara Streisand, that's the one, yeah. But no, she skipped a generation and went straight back to Judy Garland. And, of course, there was one before that as well. 37, I think it was. So, I mean, this is a well-known story of an old, grizzled performer at the very top of his game who's only got one place left to go.
Yeah.
And as he's starting on his descendancy, he encounters an up-and-coming starlet whose star is starting to rise. And as their career arcs intersect, they fall in love with each other.
Yeah.
And they basically trade fame places, if that's not an awkward way of wording it.
So that is exactly what happens, yes.
So that's the setup, isn't it?
Yes.
And so we've got Bradley Cooper, who gets his voice down to depths that I don't think any human voice really has any business going to. Mumbling and grumbling his way through it.
Yes. Mind you, he had a good coach with Sam Elliott, who's one of the deepest voices you've ever cared to have heard anywhere. But you're right.
One of the most heroic walrus mustaches I've ever seen. Yes. In fact, you know, there was one scene, I have to tell you, there's one scene where, yeah, Sam Elliott plays Bradley Cooper's brother. Yeah, Bob, Bradley Cooper plays Jackson Maine, the male lead, the singer who's on his way down. And Sam Elliott plays his brother, yes, Bobby, who's his manager and handler. And there's one scene where they're talking to each other, and I struggled to hear what they were saying.
Oh, okay.
It's like their voices were in a race to the bottom, and I think Sam Elliott probably won, but it was a close-run thing.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's the deepest, graveliest sort of voice you could ever hear from both of them.
Mumbling and rumbling like nobody's business. So you got a nice, engaging performance from Cooper. However, if we're talking about good performances, Lady Gaga steals the show. She's absolutely brilliant. If only for there is one brief moment early-ish in the film where he persuades her to come out on stage. He doesn't persuade her, he drags her out on stage to sing with him. And she's terrified. And then finally she finally decides to sing a song that she's written and then without her knowledge he's arranged into a rock song.
Yeah.
And she sings it with astonishing fire. I mean, and I always knew she was a good singer, but this was an amazing performance, because she doesn't usually sing that kind of blues country rock.
No.
And so she sings, and then there's a look on her face just for a brief moment where it is utter, unmitigated, totally ingenuous joy. Where she goes, "My God, I did it." And you think, wow, that's what an actor really looks like. I thought she blew me away there. So I thought, absolutely superb. There's a couple of other moments where there's really nice set pieces which really, really tug at the heartstrings. There's the profound humiliation scene.
Oh, yep.
Which could have been played for laughs.
Yes.
Which could have been milked for pathos. Mm. But instead was just played really, really straight. And as a result, was a kick in the guts.
Yeah.
And then the very closing performance, the last time she sings.
Yes.
Which had a lot of people, I suspect, in the cinema I saw it in, reaching in their pockets for their hankies.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Steve, Simon, actually going to slightly disagree with you.
Go ahead. Let's hear it.
Okay. I guess one of the things with any film like this, when you know you've got an established performer like Lady Gaga in the role, I tried to sort of forget that it was Lady Gaga, and I tried to assess it just on pure what we saw in the film in terms of her acting and singing. And I think it was a fantastic performance. But I actually, as the film went on, I found myself more emotionally attaching myself to Bradley Cooper's role. And maybe that's because I'm a male and he's, as is he. And that might be as simple as that. And it also might be because without giving it away or getting too personal, some of the issues he deals with and big events that occur in the film are things that have happened on the periphery of my life, and I felt some deep connection with.
Right.
So I did find myself, and also the brother thing was quite a strong element for me. That's not to denigrate in any way Lady Gaga's performance, but I've personally found more depth in the story of someone who's been at the top and is on their way down than someone aspiring to the top.
Oh, right. I think this is very personal then, because you clearly identify with someone who has reached those dizzy heights, whereas I, a mere neophyte.
That's not what I was thinking.
Clearly, I am Lady Gaga, clearly.
I'll tell you what, you were talking about wonderful moments in this film, and there are several.
Yeah.
And I think that, well, let's just deal with Lady Gaga, that wonderful, wonderful scene reasonably early on when she just does that song sitting out in a car park outside the store, and she...
unaccompanied. She's fantastic. Astonishing.
It's really, really good. There's also a brief scene near the end where the two brothers are together in a car, and the younger one gets dropped off by the older one, and they've had a falling out, and the younger one, Bradley Cooper, just gives a little thank you of a type to the older one, and we see the older one's face as he turns around to reverse the car out of the garage. And I just thought, wow, that just knocked me for six. I thought that was just fantastic. So I think there's just a massive amount of emotional content going on here, Steve. It's very hard. I can't imagine someone sitting through this and not being moved. My God, one way or the other.
Did you have something in your eye at some point, Simon?
I certainly, I did. I absolutely did.
It's a gut wrencher in places, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
The music, I think, is worth mentioning. You said before that Bradley Cooper performed. I know he sang, but I got the impression. I mean, I know that when Lady Gaga, as apparently we're supposed to call her these days, was playing the piano, that was obviously her because she is a very accomplished musician. I think they did a very, very good job of making it look like he was playing the guitar around his neck.
Probably.
They did that very, very well. They never quite dwelt on his fingers for long
No,
enough to make it look
no,
it.
I agree. No, that's yeah. But I think he carried off the role in that aspect of his performance very well.
Oh,
Just a couple
yes.
of other
Oh,
things.
yes.
I was very surprised and absolutely delighted to see New Zealand's old Marlon Williams
Oh,
pop
yes.
up at one point doing a Roy Orbison cover. I thought, well, wow, that's fantastic.
Kiwis for the win, Simon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, as I said earlier, I really enjoyed that. It's not a big role, but the actor Dave Chappelle, I think that's how you say his name. I really enjoyed his little cameo and his little conversation outside his house with Bradley Cooper. I thought that was a really nice little scene. Just Steve, what your opinion on one other thing?
Good.
Is this is in 2018 in an era of a complete reassessment of male female power roles? Could or should this film have been told the other way around? Should the established star have been a woman and the up and comer a man?
That's a very, very interesting possibility. And you have to figure somebody must have had that idea at some stage. But the impression I get from what little I've heard around about the production of the film was it was a film that Bradley Cooper wanted to make. He's the director, he's obviously the star of it, he's also a script writer in it. He wrote quite a bit of the music, or co-wrote, I should say, quite a bit of the music. It was No, a vanity project is the wrong word. That's not fair. That doesn't do it justice. But it was very much a personal, possibly a passion project for him. And I think as a result, he couldn't have made the film that he wanted if he'd done what you're suggesting. But I think that would have been a very, very interesting idea.
I mean, it does have, I think there's been a little bit of commentary around this that, yet again, you've got, the dominant male and the female starting off at least in a lesser position. Of course, that changes as you pointed out, Steve, in the course of the story. But that maybe that's a minor point. All in all, I found this. I was totally taken up in the emotional arc of the story. You kind of know where it's going, but it's some fantastic performances. They spend a lot of time with the singing, especially Lady Gaga, with the performance. I didn't mind that at all. I thought it was some very good directing by Armstrong on stage, I thought, actually.
Armstrong?
Did
Wrong
I say Armstrong?
film, Simon.
Wrong film. Sorry, I'm skipping ahead in my mind here.
So
Mr. Cooper,
did you like
maybe.
that? So you like the scene where he landed on the moon a lot, did you?
And Lady Gaga was there holding his hand and they started skipping along. I think I would really recommend this very highly. I really would.
Right. Well, before I give a recommendation, I want to add my caveats.
Yes, go on.
Because it was good, but it wasn't perfect.
Okay.
It definitely had a couple of flaws, in my opinion. There is one moment, kind of toward the end, where the female lead character Ali, played by Lady Gaga, her father, played by Andrew Dice Clay,
Yes.
and a bunch of his mates are at Jackson and Ali's house,
Yep.
and the discussion of all the records that Jackson's
Yep.
got,
Yes.
and one of the dad's mates makes just a passing flippant comment. And somebody in the audience laughed. And it suddenly
Okay.
hit me. I never expected this to be a comedy. I don't expect laugh out loud moments every 30 seconds. But it suddenly made me realize what had been bothering me about it all the way along. The dialogue is surprisingly flat. It's not the delivery, but the script itself, it's certainly not a Quentin Tarantino film, but it doesn't sparkle, it doesn't soar very much. It's very, you could say understated, but to me it felt a little bit less interesting than that. The dialogue was delivered well, but the actual writing, like I said, Bradley Cooper's really done a fantastic job. I mean, this is his film. It's absolutely his film.
Yeah.
Great director, great singer, clearly. He knows his music. He's clearly a very, very fond lover of music. Great actor. I don't know that he was the ideal script writer for this one.
Okay, that's interesting. I think that thought might have flitted across or through my mind. Maybe. I wouldn't strongly disagree with you on that point. I guess it's one of those cases, Steve, where if you are buying into the romance and the emotion, you might not dwell on that too much. But I hear what you're saying, and I'm not going to take a big issue with you on that. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
And then the other quibble.
Yes.
Is half an hour too long?
Yeah. Might be. Yep. I think the
it's 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Is it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. And there are moments, especially early on, where it feels, frankly, slow. No, I'm losing you there.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think a lot of movies these days are too long. I didn't have a strong feeling about that, Steve. I thought maybe in the middle it got a little bit, perhaps felt a bit slow. But overall, I felt the 2 hours and 15 minutes went pretty smoothly. I guess one of the issues on this sort of a story is you can see where the arc is going to take you.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's pretty. So, the filmmakers have got a big task on their hands to keep the audience locked in through what the audience knows is coming. And so in that regard, probably a half hour off might well have helped. I'd agree with you on that. But overall, I wasn't sitting there twiddling my thumbs or looking down at my watch. But I think that's a fair point you raise. I'm not going to die in the ditch to argue with you on that one.
And it's absolutely not a deal breaker. It was ultimately, overall, a lovely, lovely film.
Yeah, it certainly has a punch to it.
Oh, yes.
And it doesn't have the, let's just say, I'm not familiar with all the various versions of this film, Steve. I know the ending is not the same one as was done in 1976 with Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson, so it's not that ending. I don't know whether the one we see in this film mirrors any of the other versions, but
Apparently there are points of contact and overlap, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, I think we'd both say it's a film worth seeing, huh?
Absolutely. And I wouldn't be surprised. You know, people are already talking about Oscar buzz. I don't think it's going to get Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, any of those. Best Song.
Yeah.
That's where I see it clear. That one song, Shallows, that Lady Gaga sings is...
Yeah.
And the way she sings it as well. She won't get the Oscar because she didn't write it, but dear God, she sings it out of it like nobody's business. I was very impressed.
Yeah. I thought, we're talking a lot about this. It's one more little thing. I just on Cooper's acting, I felt like early on we see him gazing at Lady Gaga when he's falling in love with her, when we see him start to try and come to terms with the fact that his star is on the wane. I felt quite a bit of going on there with him in that role. I found there was some pretty decent acting going on there. I was certainly buying into where he was.
Yeah.
I get it from your earlier comments. You perhaps weren't so necessarily taken up by his performance per se.
No, I think you're misjudging that one. I think it's not that he was bad.
Yeah.
It's just that she was very, very good.
Okay. Oh, well, okay. We'd be bloody boring our world if we agreed on everything. Okay.
Well, one thing I think we do agree on, we're both going to recommend this wholeheartedly, aren't we?
We are, absolutely. Yep.
Right.
Take a tissue with you.
Okay, yes, I agree with you on that one. Now, I think we need to move on, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Hard keeping it so hardcore. I'm falling.
Liz. Now, this one, which I think it had critics thinking, oh, is this an Oscar contender? We've got the director, Damien Chazelle, who you may recall not that long ago had Ryan Gosling singing and dancing up a storm in La La Land. This time he's put Gosling in a space suit and he sent him to the moon.
Yes, which is a bit of a change. Now, I didn't care especially for La La Land.
No.
I was underwhelmed. So is he going to rewhelm me?
I think he probably will. So we've got Gosling, here being Neil Armstrong. I'll come back to Gosling, but just a bit more on the cast. We've got the British actress Claire Foy, who I think Steve has made a worldwide impact in that series, The Crown, playing a young Queen Elizabeth.
She's everything lately, isn't she?
Yeah, she plays the wife of Neil Armstrong, Karen.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very good performance, my gosh. And the thing that I think about this film is it does do a fantastic job taking you into 60s technology space, as the Americans did, and the scenes inside these rickety old spacecraft are superbly rendered and quite dramatic and fantastic sound and detail, and you feel like you're going to throw up with the astronaut any second.
Oh dear.
So Chazelle does a fantastic job with that. It is not a rip-roaring space adventure as, say, Tom Hanks gave us in Apollo 13.
Right,
that's not
right.
What this film is. It is a serious film. And actually, I'm glad about one thing, because I always think of Neil Armstrong as a guy I actually don't know that much about, as a guy who became one of the most famous humans in all of history, but didn't really chase the limelight. I don't think he was that sort of person. He kind of kept to himself and didn't become a celebrity, really. And I was interested to find out, Steve, whether this film might address that, give us some insight into why. And I think it did. I think it did. And I think it's actually quite a serious drama and quite a it's not so much about outer space, but it's more about the inner space of a man and his wife.
Okay.
Husband and wife, I should say, and their family and the tragedy they go through.
Right.
And I think that's where I most connected with it, actually. Because it is about a real person, and
yes.
I guess many people would know about Neil Armstrong, I will mention one aspect, and I don't think I'm giving much away. It was quite well known that Armstrong, that we see this at the beginning of the film, he has a young little daughter who's only, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old, and very sadly she dies of a brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets the template for all that we see about how he copes with the pressures, both from NASA and in space and within his own family, and why maybe he becomes this quiet, withdrawn man that he came out to be. So, I think I found it very rewarding on that level, maybe more so than the space stuff. Quite emotional as well. And I probably needed a tissue there too.
Okay.
In Ryan Gosling, what do you think? I mean, throw it back to you for a second here, Steve. Right. I don't know how many Ryan Gosling films you've seen. What's your take on how he comes across on screen?
He, unfortunately, this is going to sound a little bit unfair, possibly. He always strikes me as being a little bit sort of handsome and not necessarily an enormous amount going on behind the good-looking bloke.
Okay.
Am I being unfair?
Well, I think I agree with you that he has tended to be in roles which he has this sort of cool demeanor, doesn't he?
Yes.
He's not that emotional, or he's quite a calm. He presents a calm face, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And in some movies, like he was in that remake of Blade Runner not that long ago, and I thought he was very good in that. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. But in this case, because he's playing a man who was actually quiet and withdrawn and not that demonstrative, it's not a bad fit. So maybe it's a good bit of casting.
Right.
I did find him, it suited the role he was playing.
Right.
Claire Foy is wonderful.
When is she not?
And she's not there a huge amount, but she makes you think about the personal life, the family life of them all the time when she's there. And I'll just mention a couple of very telling and memorable scenes. One where she confronts her husband and says, "Look, mate, you're about to go to the moon. You need to sit down with your two boys, your two young sons, and explain to them what the risks involve and that they might not see their dad again."
Right, right.
And she does that wonderfully, wonderfully well. It was one of the best scenes of the movie, and it's got nothing to do with being out in space. And then I'll just mention, without spoiling it, that there's a fan, I thought, of just a beautifully emotional scene right at the very end between the husband and the wife. All I'll say is that they don't exchange a word, but they're just using their eyes to communicate all manner of things. It was I'm getting all teary just talking about
it. I can hear it in your voice. There's a catch in there, isn't there?
I thought it was just fantastic. There's a lot of good in the film. It's also quite long.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit too long. It doesn't take you through every single step of the race to the moon. But Chazelle uses a lot of handheld camera, and he's tries to get you right in up there and up close and personal with the actors. The outer space stuff, when it's there, is quite dramatic. It is good. It's serious. It's not a gung-ho movie by any stretch. It's one to not go out on a Saturday night if you're looking for a bit of a yahoo. It's more it's a more reflective film. But I could see this potentially doing well at the Oscars. I'm not sure about Gosling, but I think Claire Foy could easily be up for some sort of acting award. And maybe Chazelle for directing as well.
Well, since you mentioned going out to see it, the question that has to be asked is, do I wait till this comes onto my favourite streaming and downloading service and watch it at home, or does it need to be seen in the cinema?
I would recommend seeing it in the cinema. I really would. You could do the latter, but the sound effects are really good. I mean, you really feel like you're sitting alongside Armstrong in the capsule and in some of the test flights. I mean, and I think you'd be more drawn into that on the big screen than you would on a small. You could still get a lot out of it, but I would, if you have screen, definitely.
Fair enough, then.
I want to pass on to you now, Steve, a film that I have not seen, but you have. And I wonder whether I rightly should be envious of you, because when I saw that this this British crime caper film called King of Thieves had Michael Caine, Ray Winston, Tom Courtney, Michael Gambon, Jim Broadbent, I'm probably missing out a few, I thought, oh my gosh, this is the creme de la creme. Does the acting talent, Steve, actually deliver a good film?
I'm still not sure. Now, one thing it does have in common, I think you've misunderstood something here, Simon. One thing it does have in common with both First Man and 22 July is it's based on a true story.
My mistake. So there you are. Okay,
so you've got these five diamond geezers, right?
Right.
And so because of who we've got in it, you kind of have to do it in that. Yeah, I can't sustain. No, it's horrible, isn't it? I can't bring myself to do it. I mean,
quite well.
I mean, obviously, you can't mention the lead actor's name without pronouncing it Michael Caine, as is required. But so the basic story is about 5 years ago, there was the biggest jewel robbery in British history at Hatton Gardens in London. There was a huge safety deposit vault, and what happened was there was a chap named Brian Reader. This is Michael Caine's character, old retired bank robber, basically a thug pretty much, really, to be fair. His partner's just died. He's decided he's not doing this kind of work anymore, and then he's befriended by a chap named Basil, who says that he's got ways of getting into the vault at Hatton Gardens, and persuades him to put a crew together so that they can do the job. And so over, I think it was the Easter bank holiday weekend, when everything was quiet, they managed to get in and steal, I think, tens of millions of pounds of gold and diamonds from the Hatton Garden vault. And so you've got Michael Caine, you've got Ray Winston and Tom Courtney and Jim Broadbent as the sort of the hardcore of the crew, and also Paul Whitehouse, who is a slightly odd choice, because basically he's a comic actor, really, from things like The Fast Show, and he's quite a bit younger than the guys as well, but he fits in decently. And so they do the job, and then the job is over and done with about an hour into a film that's nearly 2 hours long.
Okay.
And so what happens then is you then, having had, you know, a fairly decent film, which starts off giving every indication it's going to be a classic 1960s British caper.
Yeah.
It's got Michael Caine in it. It's got every indication it's going to be that kind of slightly sort of a British Oceans film, if you'd like.
Okay.
It's going to have a little bit of swagger and a little bit of sparkle to it. And it never really quite finds its feet in that regard.
Okay.
It's likable enough, but it never really quite sparkles and shines the way you want it to. And then the job is done, and then the gang start to fall apart as nobody trusts anybody else about divvying up the proceeds.
Okay. Yep.
And they reveal themselves, all of them, to be utterly foul and reprehensible individuals. And even though there's one point, one line I noted down, Michael Caine's character at one point says that nobody's going to suspect him because they'll think we're just a load of lovely old crooks just having a laugh.
Yeah.
Except they're nothing but lovely.
No.
They turn out to be absolutely unpleasant. You've got someone, like I say, you know, Tom Courtney or Jim Broadbent. How could you ever expect them to play nasty, thoroughly unlikable characters on screen?
Especially
Tom Courtney. I mean, Ray Winston, he's been playing he's been playing Carlin from Scum since the 1970s. I don't think he's ever done anything any different. And so he does his usual thing like Ray Winston always does. That's all he ever does, isn't it?
That's right.
And you expect him to be a bit of a thug. And he is. And he comports himself in the same way that he always does. But you expect Michael Caine and Jim Broadbent and Tom Courtney to play characters who are a bit more gentlemanly, and they're not. They're foul. And it wrong-foots you so badly, you don't quite know where it's going. And the characters don't manage to redeem themselves. They don't manage, in my opinion, to pull themselves together and make this a likable film enough. There's not enough. Again, as I said with The Star Is Born, we got a cast like that with that kind of setup, when it's like this kind of classic heist caper, you expect a bit of sharp dialogue, a bit of witty banter.
Yeah.
And the more to consider about talking about the dicky hips.
Yeah. Well, I guess I gather from what you're saying that the director and the writers must have made a deliberate decision that they wanted to play it this way. They didn't want to do a lighthearted caper. They actually wanted to do something with a bunch of nasty blokes and say, don't try and turn these blokes into heroes. These are robbers and thugs.
Yeah.
And we're going to show you that this is what they are. But does that make a good piece of entertainment is the question.
Well, no. In my opinion, I don't know it did, because the film starts off like the first half, let's say, where we're doing the prep and then we're doing the actual job itself. Makes you think it's trying and not quite pulling off being that film, the caper. And then suddenly the tone of the film shifts somewhat abruptly in a way that I wasn't completely crazy about. And there's one scene at the end, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but there's one scene at the very end when they're being marched into court to be sentenced. Like I say, it's a true story. I don't think you can worry too much about spoilers. We know they got nicked. And I'm going to come back to how they got nicked in a second, because that in itself is very oddly done. But they're marched into court from a little changing room where they've been brought from the cells in their prison jumpsuits, and they're getting changed and they're bickering with each other a little bit, and then they're getting marched off to the court, and the camera lingers on the face of each one in turn, and then there's a little black and white cutaway of one of them in their younger days. So you got Michael Caine in the 1960s something or other, in a dapper little suit. You've got Ray Winston in Scum being Carlin, and it's meant to remind you of who these guys were in their younger days when they were diamond gazers doing all these blags and jobs, right? And you're thinking, okay, well, if that's what you want to invoke, why the hell didn't you have them being that character
earlier on
for the last 45 minutes? It's very odd trying to figure out what the film's trying to be tonally. It's really, really jarring.
Okay, that's interesting.
But there is one other thing I have to mention that I thought was a very, very odd decision. Most of the coppers, and there's a little bit about how the police pulled the investigation together, how they identified them, and there's very, very little speaking part for any of the police.
Okay.
In particular, there are two women, a detective constable and a detective sergeant, one of whom is sitting there, the DC is sitting there watching the video camera footage.
Yeah.
and she notices something a little bit off and points it out to her detective sergeant.
Right.
And the DS then follows this up with the higher ups.
Yeah.
And then they go to they do the arrest. Neither of those two women speaks a single word. And it's very, very odd the way one waves the other over and then points at the screen and the other one nods without speaking. It's very marked, it's very awkward, and you wonder why they made a pointed decision to have basically the apart from Reader's wife, who dies early in the film, very, very early, the only two significant female characters don't get a speaking role.
I've got no idea why that would be.
No, it really bothered me. It really bothered me that bit.
Yeah.
So yeah. Is it good? Is it worth seeing? I don't know. I was hoping you'd have had a chance to see it because I wanted your take on this because I don't know and it's killing me.
I know. Well, I wish I had just so we could compare notes. I just ran out of time. But
that's fair enough.
I think, yeah. Well, you have put me off because I was expecting it to be a bit sharper and a bit more of a caper. But I acknowledge the talent and the quality of the cast. But yeah, I'm not sure if I'd want to see it or not, actually. But that's okay.
Oh, there's no denying the quality of the acting. I'm just not don't quite know I liked what they acted.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's not bad. How could it be?
No, it's not. Yeah, but it didn't quite connect in the way you were hoping or you think it should have connected.
No. Now, should we talk about a film that really does connect on the most visceral, appallingly?
Yes, we must.
I think we have to do this.
We do. Well, First Man was a true story. King of Thieves was a true story, and this film called 22nd July is a true story of the very recent past. It's from the British director Paul Greengrass, and it's about that awful 2011 massacre of 77 people, most of them young students in Norway. They were killed by this right-wing extremist called Anders Behring Breivik. And we've got Greengrass, as he did in his, I thought, fantastic film called United 93, Steve, which told the story of the 9/11 attacks in New York and out in Washington. Here he is taking a serious look at an awful event. Does it work, though, as a movie? Is this the sort of topic that you should say, well, I'll just leave this to a documentary maker or to a journalist? You know, what are we getting out of portraying something like this as a dramatic piece of movie entertainment? I'm not sure entertainment is even the right word, but I think that's a good question. And I've got some thoughts, but what do you think? We've both seen it.
We have. And I mean, you asked the question of entertainment and yeah, I mean, why does one even choose to watch a film like this?
Yeah.
Let alone make it, and I think the answer has to be, it's a different take on it. I mean, a documentary will present simply the facts and nothing else, but I think narrating the story, especially with the delicacy and the deft touch that Greengrass brings to it, I think makes you understand the events in a very, very clear way. It's a story that he needed telling. Apparently, he did approach the families of the victims and asked their permission to make the film, and wholeheartedly he was encouraged to do so because they said that they wanted the world to know the story of their children, for the most part, who were murdered by Breivik, and he clearly took his responsibility very, very seriously. Because the other thing, apparently, that the family said, and I think you'll agree with me on this, they said, tell the story, tell it clearly, do not flinch away from showing what happened, but at the same time, do not sensationalise it.
Yes.
And that's a very, very fine line he had to walk.
It is. And I think he achieved it. And he does that by adopting the style almost a low-key style, in a way.
Yes.
He lets the events unfold in front of you. He doesn't embellish them with stirring music. A lot, especially early on, there's hardly any soundtrack at all.
No.
He's not using big-name actors. He's not, he's letting the people talk like ordinary people talk. There's no great, overblown script. It's got an everyday feel to it, and he's letting the events unfold and speak for themselves. So I think he deserves a great deal of credit for that. He does show in some detail the deaths and the killing. But I think you're right, Steve. In so doing, we are given the reason or the understanding of, or an attempted understanding of what those families went through,
Yes.
as awful as it was. And he quite rightly mostly uses one particular family as a vehicle to tell the story of the victims. This is the family in this film called the Hansen family. And he does give us a fair bit of time with Breivik, but I thought, I'd just know what you think on this. I don't know if I necessarily truly got to the bottom of what was going on with Breivik. We see his mother in the film. We don't really get a lot of insight into Breivik in terms of the whys and wherefores. I don't think we do anyway. How did that part of the film work for you?
Well, it's a very, very difficult decision that a filmmaker has to make in a case like this, because I think that there's parallels with the fact that Breivik wanted to speak in his trial,
Yes.
and a lot of the victims and their families didn't want him to,
Yeah.
because they didn't want to give him a platform. They didn't want to give him the opportunity to spout his filth. But the fact is that you cannot simply, if you're telling the story, remove him from it, because obviously without him there would be no story. He is pivotal to it, obviously. And so there are ways of doing it which present what he did, but without having to start examining his motives. Because once you start doing that, you get dangerously close to starting to try and understand him. And
Yes,
which
yes.
then gets dangerously close to, are you justifying him? And
Yes.
I think that's, I'm put get putting myself in Greengrass's head here, obviously, but I suspect that that was part of the danger that he was having to deal with, is you don't really want to try and give him an opportunity in your
No.
film to explain why he did it.
No. And I thought Greengrass, in that aspect, Steve, I thought he did a wonderful job in showing Breivik's defense lawyer,
Yes.
who is played by an actor called John Øygarden, and who's has to do his duty,
Yeah.
but clearly is finding it the most horrific, odious thing he's ever had to do. And I think the actor did a fantastic job in trying to keep a stiff upper lip, do his job, but in trying to hide the disgust he felt. I thought that was and a very clever move, so because that's a constant reminder to us, for someone who's in contact with Breivik, this man has done abysmal things. So yeah, I think that's right. I think the family who give us the main story, the Hansen family, there's two boys, and the older one is the one who's really the story's built around him. His Viljar is his name. He's played by an actor called Jonas Strand Gravli. He does a very, very good job, I think. And there's a young girl he bef student who befriends called Lara, played by Seda Witt. And those two are kind of the heart and soul of the film in many ways. And they both, at the end, give re bearing in mind these are young, educated students. They're attending a political labor youth camp, so they're articulate and intelligent kids. They're not. They don't, they can speak, and they both give very telling little speeches in the
Yeah,
court at the end,
and
which,
I think this was a fantastic decision that Greengrass made, was, as you said, Vilja and Lara are the heart of the film, and so it's about them. It's not about Anders Breivik.
No.
It's not about him. He did bad things to Vilja and to Lara, but it's about them. And as a
Yes.
result, that's how you avoid having to delve into his background and possibly start to finding things
Yeah.
to identify with.
Yeah.
Instead, you make the focus about these guys. And yeah, he did atrocious things to them, but it's not about him, it's about them. And I think that's part of the strength of it.
Yeah.
It's worth mentioning, obviously, you say Vilja is played by Jonas Strand Gravli, who is what? He's about 18 years old, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
And
something
it's
like that. Yeah.
worth mentioning that there isn't a single line of dialogue in Norwegian. The entire film's in English.
Yes.
Every single actor is Norwegian.
Yes.
And I mean, let's face it. You and I, we've both been to Norway this year. We both know that your average Norwegian speaks English better than most English people do.
That is
That
absolutely true.
they are quite remarkably bilingual
Yes,
people.
they
And
are.
so these guys, I mean, they're fantastic actors. There's some amazing acting
There
going on.
is.
Whether
There
whether
is.
it's on this Lear who plays Breivik, or you've got, where is he? Where is his name? Yeah, but named Ola. Ola Furuseth, I think is pronounced, who plays Jens Stoltenberg, the Prime Minister.
Yes.
You know, these guys are brilliant. They do superb performances, and you forget they're acting in a foreign language.
Yes, I know.
Their acting is, I mean, it's very naturalistic. It's very underplayed. As you said, the dialogue is very understated because there's no attempt to make this into some piece of soaring magnificence. He
No.
clearly wanted to focus on the mundane normality of these are everyday people who were just going about their business, doing an activity that is completely reasonable and normal, and then this complete wanker shows up and starts killing them. And so it's a part of the brilliance of the film, I think, is the degree to which it is understated.
Yeah, I agree. And it is a very powerful piece of filmmaking. Not easy to watch, but I would recommend it. I found it compelling. And in its own way, because of the way in which the victims are focused on, it is actually rewarding. And I just want to add one other thing, Steve. And you mentioned the commitment and the talent of those Norwegian actors. And we also get through this film a bit of an insight into how, I suppose, for want of a better word, civilized Norwegian society is, that they could
Yes.
deal with a man as awful as Breivik and deal with him properly through the courts of law
Yes.
and with a degree of maintaining their own dignity. And I put something in our website, my review of the website. We should have mentioned it's cravepodcast.com.
We have not mentioned that yet today,
No,
Simon. We're slacking.
cravepodcast.com. And this might sound a bit self-indulgent, but I don't mean it to
No,
be.
I know I know where you go with this.
Yeah.
I think it's worth a mention, really.
Well, it's just that it so happens that when this happened in 2011, I was at that point working as a co-host of Radio New Zealand's Morning Report program with Geoff Robinson. And this event happened when I was working in that job. And so as a result, I did a number of interviews about it. And on our website, I've just put a link to a couple of those interviews. One was with a correspondent who I thoroughly thought was a wonderful correspondent. His name was Tom Christiansen, and he presented a he told us the story without getting overly emotional, but in a very dignified and poised way. And then also that happened that one of the kids who was killed, the youngest of them, was actually had a mother born in New Zealand.
Oh wow, I didn't know that.
Her name was the mother's name is Vanessa. Vanessa, and her daughter Sheridan was killed. She was only 14. And we did a couple of interviews with Vanessa, and I put a link on our cravepodcast.com website to the RNZ website where you can listen to two of those interviews, one I did with Tom Christensen and one with Vanessa, the mother. And I've done this because I think if you get a chance to listen to them, you will get a sense of what the actual people involved in this awful thing went through and how they comported themselves and how you can sort of get a, I don't know, feel so awed by their composure and their dignity. And it's that those interviews have stayed with me, 6, 7 years later, I still think back on those. And so this is about journalism, not movie making, but I just think this is a story of a real event. It's not didn't happen that long ago, and you might get a bit more of an insight by having a listen to that. Anyway, it's a very powerful film and worth seeing.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, like you said, not an easy watch,
No.
not even entertainment.
No,
But
no.
I mean, think of it in these terms. This is a tribute to the 77 people that Pillock murdered, and see it as a tribute to them, and is also, as you say, to the dignity and to the humanity and compassion that, as far as I can tell, the entire country of Norway exhibited it when they could so easily have gone into full-on vengeance and anger mode,
Yes,
and they
right.
managed. And certainly, the impression we're given from the Prime Minister down, the entire country exhibited, and apparently still do. Well, your man's still alive, and he's still in prison. He still kicks
Yes,
up every now and
yes.
then, and the entire country of Norway, as far as I can tell, has just simply acted with the most astonishing dignity.
I agree. Yeah, I agree, and it comes through in the film. It really does.
Yeah.
Whew. Right.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Come on. Come on. Shake it off, Simon. Deep breaths.
Deep breath. That's right. Thank you. Thank
right.
You.
Right. Musical relief. Yeah, musical relief, because we need it at this stage. Because that, I mean, we talked about some heavy films.
We have.
There, to
we
be fair. So, yes. so music. Let's get musical, shall we? But hang on. Australian blues, is that going to do it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. You think after that, the last thing we need is to be talking about some blues music.
Simon, tell me about blues music.
Yeah. But I did get to see. That's why you were away overseas, Steve. An Australian band. They're out of Melbourne, or Victoria. They're called the Teskey Brothers. That's Teskey. Teskey Brothers.
That's an awkward name, though, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And they did a show in Auckland City. There are actually two brothers, hold on, let me just get my thoughts together here. So we've got John Teskey is the lead guitarist, and Josh is the lead guitar as the lead vocalist, and Sam is on lead guitar. That's two Teskey brothers, and then you've got a couple of mates, the bass player and the drummer, are lifelong friends, apparently, Steve. And they brought with them a couple of horn players, trumpeter and trombonist. And so what we've got is young people playing really what sounded like, and I think kind of old-fashioned blues, soul blues. I've heard people talk of them in the same breath as a sort of a Otis Redding, Sam Cooke, Van Morrison sort of genre feel
tone. Oh, wow. That's pretty wide ranging, isn't it?
It is. With the horns, it gave it much more of a soul feel.
Yeah.
They were really good. I mean, I think they were. They've been on the road for a long time. They played live for a long time at lots of bars and clubs in Australia. I think it shows. They've got a confidence and an ease on stage. Josh, the front man, the singer, he's got a very warm, gravelly, bluesy voice.
Yeah.
The lead guitarist Sam has got some really nice touches on the guitar. They do sing and perform, I guess, sort of traditional blues and soul songs. I don't think there's no huge departure from that genre.
Right.
But they just bring a youthful energy into it.
Oh, right.
And a feeling that, well, let me throw this over to you. You know, why should we enjoy the blues? Isn't the blues about making us feel sad? And that was a question I was sort of just trying to get to grips with afterwards, because I enjoyed it and I felt good about it. But I thought, well, these guys are singing sad songs. Why should I be feeling good about it?
Well,
what does the blues do for us is the answer, a question, I guess.
Well, did you not find yourself choking about the tears at A Star Is Born?
Yes, I did.
Is that not the cinematic equivalent of singing the blues?
I guess it is. I guess it is. And I guess the thing about this music is, yes, they're singing about hard times and they're singing about painful times. But I guess by sharing that, they're saying, well, we're not bowed by that. And we understand that probably you guys out there in the audience have been through the same. And we can sort of take comfort in the fact we've all been through stuff like this, and we can come out the other end, and it's okay to talk about it and sing about it, because that's life. And somehow in a weird way becomes a heartfelt, almost a celebration of life. It doesn't, perhaps it's a little bit odd, but I was actually smiling through most of this concert.
Well, there you go. That clearly they know how to play the blues.
Yeah. And really well. I was surprised not just at what good musicians they were, but how they got across the feel of the music.
Yeah.
Really nicely. And I really was drawn into it. And so if they come back, and I hope they do, I would really recommend it. And even if you're not a big fan of blues and soul music, I think you'd like these guys. They've got a good vibe about them, a positive vibe. And yep, definitely a good one.
Might just have to be there.
Sometimes trying to just get back. When you get broken down again, it ain't because you didn't try. I try to count the days that I've been disappointed. So many home times it gives you joining, but it's hard trying to make a living.
Okay. Now, now we've started on music. Shall we carry on with music? We've had a few announcements, I think, of late, Steve, about musical acts hitting our way.
There's a few to
bring us up to date.
There's a few to mention, actually. Yeah. Maybe not the most exciting one, but it's kind of an interesting one. We had Guns N' Roses came here a couple of years ago.
Yes.
But then we've had what was his name? Steven Adler played a solo date. Earlier in the year, and now we've got Slash, the guitarist from Guns N' Roses, is doing a solo date, and he's got Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators as his backing band, and he's going to be in Tauranga and Auckland in late January, 25th and 26th. He's going to come to town. So I guess we're getting like the entire band now drip fed to us. I think that's how that's going to work.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. At the other end of the spectrum, this is a bit closer to the Teskey Brothers, I guess. John Prine. Recognize the name?
I do.
The American singer songwriter. His first visit to New Zealand in 25 years.
Wow. Okay.
I know. And he's getting around as well. So he's going to start off at the Bruce Mason Centre in Auckland on the 27th of February, 28th at the Isaac Theatre Royal in Christchurch. And then he's getting a couple of days off because, you know, he's getting old. before he goes on the 2nd of March to TSB Arena in Wellington.
Still staying with
names from the past.
Yes.
Brian Ferry.
I've seen the posters around the town. Yeah.
Of course you have, yes. TSB Arena in Wellington, 5th of March, I beg your pardon. Mm-hmm. Thursday, the 7th of March, Spark Arena in Auckland. That one could be very, very good. Even if you don't like his music, you know he's going to put on a very, very slick and polished show.
Yeah.
An interesting event.
Yes.
Mumford & Sons.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah. Now, they're doing, they're calling it a mammoth one-day festival-style show.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's going to be at the Outer Fields at Western Springs.
Okay.
Now, in terms of the performance, the production, you know as much as I do now, but they've got Leon Bridges, Michael Kiwanuka, Angie McMahon, and Sam Fender, and other artists soon to be announced.
Okay.
So it's going to be a decent day out.
Yeah. So that's the same venue, Steve, that I went along at last summer for the what was called the Auckland City Limits Festival.
Yes. Yes.
That's where I saw Grace Jones and Alien Weaponry and a few other artists like that. So that actually was not I thought it was quite a good venue. It's certainly a very central venue. That could be pretty good.
It could indeed. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's going to be. What date did it say? I've lost the date now. It's on my website somewhere, Simon. Saturday, January the 12th. There you go. And the only thing that puts me off is it says in the press release, if I can find the language, it says, Mumford & Sons themselves curate the day's entertainment.
Oh.
Exactly. Yes. They're curating it. So I'm not quite sure what to make of that. Stepping away from music just for a second, but it's worth mentioning because it'll be brilliant. Eddie Izzard. Doing his Wunderbar tour. He's going to be in Wellington on the 26th of February, Christchurch on the 27th, and then Auckland, again, taking a couple of days off, Friday the 1st of March at Spark Arena. And then back to music. There's a couple of interesting ones. Now, what's the name of the band who recorded Hotel California?
The name of the band which recorded Hotel California, as far as I recall, was The Eagles.
And do you know, you're actually wrong.
Okay. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, apparently, and I didn't know this until I read the press releases and started to look at this, apparently they're just called Eagles. Apparently. Although, having said that, even the press release that was sent to us goes backwards and forwards between Eagles and The Eagles. But on all their posters, all their publicity material, it only says Eagles. So apparently that's the official name of the band. However, I mean, you can call them Susan if you want. They're still coming to Auckland.
Okay.
Tuesday, the 26th of February at Spark Arena. And then a couple of days later, they're going down to Forsyth Bar Stadium in Dunedin on the 2nd of March.
Right. Wow.
So they're coming to town.
Yes.
Now, there's one that we're not going to mention.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to mention that Eminem is coming to New Zealand on Saturday the 2nd of March. And the reason we're not mentioning that,
yes,
is because he's only going to Wellington.
Ah, yes. I wouldn't mention it.
No, because he's not coming to Auckland. I'm not going to mention it to anyone.
No,
because he is frankly dead to us at this point. But one that is worth mentioning, just one last one.
No, go on.
Which is so fresh that I've not even had a chance to put it on the website yet.
Oh, I know what you're going to tell me.
What am I going to tell you?
I think you're going to tell me about The Prodigy.
Ah, I'd forgotten about that one. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Oh, that's another one.
Yes,
okay.
Glad you mentioned that. We'll come to that one in a second because I don't have the email in front of me right now. No, this one's a bit closer to home for me. This is the Happy Mondays.
I don't know the Happy Mondays.
You don't know the Happy Mondays? They're from they're not from Manchester. They're from Salford. Actually, to be exact, they're from Swinton and Little Halton.
Oh, I'm glad you told me that.
No, exactly where they're from.
Makes all the difference, yeah.
They were at the forefront of the Manchester scene back in the 1990s with albums like Pills and Thrills and Bellyaches, which they're actually going to play in full.
Okay.
Oh, well, if you're from Manchester or even anywhere in England, you're my age, you'll know exactly who the Mondays are.
It's a good name.
Oh, Happy Mondays. They were brilliant, yeah. the most drug-inflected band for decades. Seriously, yeah. And they're going to be at the Power Station in Auckland on the 28th of February.
Okay.
But now you've mentioned The Prodigy. Now I have to find that email.
I've just found it myself. So all I can say is it's next year, 2019. They're coming to Auckland's Trusts Arena on the 5th of February. And they've got a new album coming out in November this year. It's called No Tourists. I'm just looking to see if they're playing anywhere else here other than Auckland. I haven't quite got that far, but it's just Auckland. That one Auckland date, the 5th of February, so it's the day before Waitangi Day in Auckland. But I don't know a lot. I mean, I've heard the name. I know they're sort of an electronic type act, aren't they?
Steve? Yes,
like
yes.
The Prodigy. I think they've been very successful in Europe and Britain, but beyond that, I don't know a heck of a lot about them, to be honest with you. But they're coming as well. It's getting to be a bit busy. The calendar's getting a bit filled up.
It's going to be fantastic, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
And
go on.
And of course, the big name coming up very shortly. Let's not forget Taylor Swift.
Let's not.
How could you?
No. Well, I have to say this: that Taylor Swift has become more interesting to me since was it last week or the week before she got into a bit of hot bother with some right wing supporters because she came out quite unequivocally against Trump.
Yeah.
And copped some flack, but obviously copped some support from others as well.
That's going to endear it to you, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
So in case you've not already snapped up your tickets, Mount Smart Stadium in Auckland on the 9th of November.
Okay. Hey, and just one other thing. I have been noticing on YouTube in the last week or two, Steve, that we're starting to get some videos come through from the Fleetwood Mac tour in North America.
Oh, yes.
And I've seen so far them do two Neil Finn songs.
Really?
Yeah, they've done the obvious one, Don't Dream It's Over. And they've also done an old split-end song called I Got You.
Oh, wow.
Which is just kind of interesting that they've allowed Mr. Finn some room to perform his own material. I think that's kind of interesting. So I'm sure they're going to come here. They must. They must.
You would have thought, wouldn't you?
You would.
I mean, now that they're basically crowded Mac.
Oh, wonderful. Quote of the day.
Fleetwood House.
Brilliant. Thank you. Oh, look, you just made the podcast. Thank you so much.
Saved the best bit till the end.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Well, I think we should, I can't top that. So we'll get out while the going's good. Steve, thank you.
Thank you, Simon.
For another week.
It is indeed. Mercifully.
Yes, we would love to hear from you guys. You can email Steve and I at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Crave Podcast.
We are. And so without further ado, I'm Simon Mercip.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Oh, yes.
Lovely jubbly, Mr. McCabe.
Well, that was an hour.
Ooh. Bloody hell. Well...